Yes, thank you. I would like to thank the organizers, in particular Alain, for inviting me here to this very prestigious place and to this very interesting meeting. My lab is interested in the role of the extracellular matrix during development, plasticity, and regeneration of the nervous system. And the extracellular matrix consists of glycoproteins, proteoglycans, and complex glycans. And recently, Bill Hines has proposed that one can identify a core group of about 300 genes that he termed the matrisome core that form the important core group of this structure of the matrix. And the matrix components interact in the pericellular environment and form complex interactomes of proteoglycans and glycoproteins that are further bound together by long strands of hyaluronic acid. And these hyaluronic acid strands are attached to cell surfaces either by hyaluronic synthase or by hyaluronic acid receptors. In addition, specific receptors such as the integrins we have heard about are important to recognize glycoproteins. And there are also some receptors for glycosaminoglycans, such as the chondroitin sulfate receptors. In addition, the matrix contains binding and docking sites for cytokines and also for morphogens. So overall, it's a very complex system that on top of that is dynamic and plastic. And we have focused on this system in certain situations, and one of them where the extracellular matrix and this interactome is of great interest is the stem cell niche. The niche of stem cells consists of the stem cell itself, niche cells, and the environment of the extracellular matrix that forms a privileged environment for stem cells and thereby contributes to their maintenance. It is well known that niche areas are quite rare. In the nervous system, you have exactly two. And it's thought that these niches integrate both local and systemic factors, and in addition, sense pathological and physiopathological alterations in the system and convey these signals to the niche compartment and to the stem cells that subsequently differentiate into different pathways. And in our work, we have focused on the idea that the extracellular matrix environment of the niche in the central nervous system impacts on maintenance and also differentiation pathways of neural stem cells. And this concept has been inspired by an early observation in collaboration with Dennis Steindler's lab many years ago, that two matrix components we were studying in the context of neuron-glia interactions, namely the glycoprotein of the matrix tenascin C and the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan, we call DSD1 proteoglycan, are both highly and specifically enriched in the adult niche of the subventricular zone of the nervous system. And tenascin C is one of the components of the interstitial matrix of the nervous system, which contains tenascins interacting with chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans of the lecticin family. We have found this DSD1 proteoglycan, and I will now discuss some studies we have carried out in order to understand the functions of this chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan in the stem cell niche. This also because here there's a lot of interest in chondroitin sulfates in this institution. So the adult stem cells are thought to be late descendants of the stem cells that occur during development. And in lysencephalic systems, the major stem cell of the nervous system is the radial glia cell that divides symmetrically but also engages in asymmetric division patterns, giving rise to neurons, then oligodendrocytes, and finally astrocytes in three successive waves. In addition, in gerencephalic systems, we have an additional class of stem cells termed the basal radial glia, autoradial glia cell. We have focused on this compartment in order to understand in more detail roles of DSD1 proteoglycan, which we characterized on the molecular level and cloned and sequenced. And in the end, it turned out that DSD1 proteoglycan is the mouse homologue of a proteoglycan known as phosphocarn in the rat. Now, phosphocarn is an isoform of a larger receptor called receptor protein tyrosine phosphatase beta-zeta, a tyrosine phosphatase molecule. And in the external part, we have a carboanhydrase domain, we have a fibronectin type 3 domain, and a long intervening sequence that carries the chondroitin sulfate attachment sites. In the large form, we have in addition tyrosine phosphatase modules, which link a cell surface chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan to signal transduction pathways. And the tyrosine phosphatases themselves place this gene into a larger gene family where we can distinguish membrane-bound systems and cytoplasmic tyrosine phosphatases. All in common, they antagonize the receptor tyrosine kinase pathway. So there is an interesting link from chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans to this pathway. In addition, we have seen that in these chondroitin sulfates, there's the binding site of a monoclonal antibody we called 473HD. And I will discuss this domain further, because it turned out to be an interesting tool to understand chondroitin sulfates in the stem cell environment. And indeed, when we use this antibody that reacts with this chondroitin sulfate, we clearly see an expression of the epitope in a culture model of stem cells and also in the embryonic cortex where it co-localizes with radial glia. And there we found a very nice co-localization of the epitope with classical stem cell markers such as RC2, but also BLBP and other radial glia markers such as GLAST. These radial glial cells can be cultivated in the model of neurospheres that consist of stem cells and their progeny, and can be subcultivated for many different generations, provided the neural stem cell itself is conserved. And we could show that this antibody here recognizes most, if not all, of these stem cells using different techniques such as immunosorting and immunopanning protocols. So we think that the antibody reacts with a specific and novel marker of radial glia surfaces. Now the question is, how can that be? Because these chondroitin sulfates are rather ubiquitously expressed in the nervous system. So how can we explain that a chondroitin sulfate shows this degree of specificity? And in order to understand this point, we have engaged in a long-standing collaboration with a group in Japan, with Kazuyuki Sugahara, who is a specialist of chondroitin sulfate structures. And generally, chondroitin sulfates consist of long strands of carbohydrate dimers built up of glucuronic acid and galactosamine. And in these dimers, we have attachment sites for sulfate groups that specify different types of chondroitin sulfate. And to cut a very long story short, Kazuyuki's lab has been able to purify hexamers and also octamers of chondroitin sulfate strands of known composition. And using these glycosaminoglycan arrays, we found that our antibody specifically reacts with motifs that contain chondroitin sulfate D. And chondroitin sulfate D is dependent on a certain form of sulfation, so we think that the domain recognized by this antibody is based on chondroitin sulfate D units and sulfation. Furthermore, we found that this domain overlaps with docking sites for cytokines such as pleiotropin and MITkine, and it's thought that the specificity is caused by specific surfaces that are created in these glycosaminoglycan stretches and form interaction phases for proteins. So there is a certain degree of specificity in that. We have looked at the neural stem cells and found that the enzymes you need to transfer the sulfate groups to their positions here in yellow, to transfer these sulfate groups, the sulfotransferases are clearly expressed in the stem cell niche. We find them in the subventricular zone of the lateral ventricle, as well as in the neurospheres themselves. So the machinery required to create, for example, the D unit that is shown here is present. And the question was whether this sulfation is also of some functional relevance for the behavior of the stem cells. And a very simple test to assay for that is to prevent sulfation of glycosaminoglycans by using chlorate. And when we use chlorate, as predicted, we lose the binding site of our monoclonal antibody because this one is based on sulfation and chondroitin sulfate T. And the second effect, we see that the proliferation of neurospheres is reduced in response to EGF and FGF2. So it seems that the sulfation itself is important for signal transduction pathways that are required for stem cell proliferation. Now, one could argue that in this case also the heparan sulfates are affected, and in order to focus in more detail on the chondroitin sulfates, we applied an enzyme that is widely used, meanwhile, also in experimental neurology. This is chondroitinase ABC, an enzyme of bacterial origin that selectively degrades chondroitin sulfates and hyaluronic acid in the milieu of the extracellular matrix, leaving core proteins disentangled, so the interactome of the matrix is to some extent disrupted. This, however, is not really causing negative effects on cell viability. And we have used this enzyme and monitored what happens to the stem cell compartment under these conditions. And again, we see, as predicted, that the binding site of the monoclonal antibody here is removed by chondroitinase ABC, as it should be, because it's a chondroitin sulfate domain. We see also that we remove this biochemically here by Western blot, and we still see the core protein recognized by a polyclonal antibody, that is the RPTP beta zeta core protein that exposes this epitope in neural stem cells. As a further effect, we see that the neurospheres settle down on the culture substrate and begin to differentiate. We have emigrating, differentiating cells moving out of these neurospheres. And in addition, we see that the number of neurospheres is reduced by chondroitinase ABC treatment, as well as the incorporation of BRDU under treatment conditions. So we think that the chondroitin sulfates are important for the proliferation of these stem cells. And this is also true in vivo, because the injection of chondroitinase ABC into the ventricle of embryonic mice in vivo leads to a reduction of PH3 labeling in the treated ventricle, as well as to a reduction of BRDU incorporation in vivo. So we think that this dependence of proliferation of neural stem cells on chondroitin sulfate motifs also holds true for the in vivo situation. Furthermore, we found that under conditions of chondroitinase ABC treatment, the differentiation pathway of neurospheres is changed. We see a reduction of neurons in the neurospheres, so we see a reduction of neurogenesis, and we see an increase of GFAP expression, that is an increase of astrocytes under treatment conditions. And we find that quite interesting, because it could suggest that the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans are somehow involved in regulating the ratio of neurons to astrocytes, a parameter that is strictly and strongly controlled in terms of evolution. And maybe the removal of the chondroitin sulfates accelerates the maturation pathway of stem cells at the expense of neurons and for the benefit of astrocytes along this temporal axis. So this is an idea we are currently studying further. We have also looked at the signaling systems that may be affected in this context and used subculture protocols. And as you can see intuitively already, it seems that the FGF2-dependent pathway is more affected than the EGF-dependent pathway in the neurosphere model. And this is also illustrated by the fact that upon chondroitinase ABC treatment on the signaling level, we have a reduction of phosphoMAP kinase signaling in the treated cells, but not in the EGF-treated cells. So we think that the chondroitin sulfates are important for the control of stem cell proliferation, and they are also important for the differentiation pathways. And it seems as if chondroitin sulfate enrichment in the adult stem cell niche, for example, could have the sense to maintain stem cells and to retard to some extent differentiation processes. Because oligodendrocytes are generated from these stem cells, we have also focused on the oligodendrocyte compartment. These cells are important for myelinating the axon. And there is an interest in extracellular matrix and myelin formation, because in demyelinated areas, extracellular matrix including chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans, is upregulated, and it's possible to study the oligodendrocyte precursors using in vitro culture systems where the different differentiation stages of oligodendrocyte precursors to myelinating cells can nicely be reproduced and identified thanks to specific markers such as the PDGF receptor and NG2 for early stages, O4 for immature oligodendrocytes and myelin basic protein for mature oligodendrocytes that under adequate conditions will even start to myelinate exons in vitro. And when we look in that system and look at the expression of the DSD1 chondroitin sulfate domain, we see that we have a very nice expression of this epitope in conjunction with oligodendrocyte precursor surface markers such as NG2 but also O4, while the induction of differentiation of oligodendrocyte precursors by the addition of thyroid hormone to the culture system leads to a downregulation of the epitope, both on the biochemical level but also here seen by immunocytology. So the 473HD chondroitin sulfate domain goes down with maturation of the oligodendrocyte precursor cells. And here also we have wondered what actually the function of the chondroitin sulfates for the differentiation of the OPCs could be. And in order to test this question, we have purified chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan fractions from the conditioned medium of oligodendrocyte precursor cells and incubated oligodendrocyte precursors in the presence of proteoglycan as compared to polyornithine and tested their differentiation behavior. And you can nicely see that the acquisition of myelin basic protein as a maturational marker in oligodendrocytes is inhibited by proteoglycans of oligodendrocyte origin and rescued by treatment with chondroitinase ABC. And we see that within 2 but also within 3 days. So it seems that oligodendrocyte precursors are sort of timed in their differentiation behavior by chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans, as well as the formation of membranes and the expansion of oligodendrocyte membranes that is enhanced by chondroitinase ABC treatment. So the percentage of membrane-forming cells is clearly enhanced by chondroitinase ABC treatment, both on a neutral substrate as well as on a proteoglycan-conditioned substrate. So we can conclude that actually a chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan-rich environment will sort of inhibit oligodendrocyte differentiation and membrane expansion. We think that this may be relevant for the pathology of myelin, an aspect we are currently following further. These observations are not limited to rodent oligodendrocyte precursors, but seem also to hold true for human oligodendrocytes that we could derive from induced pluripotent stem cells in collaboration with Oliver Brüstler in Bonn. You see here very nice expression of the chondroitin sulfate domain in OLIG2 positive cells. Upon treatment with chondroitinase ABC, we have an enhanced maturation and an increase of myelin basic protein expression in that system as well. So it seems also to be relevant for human oligodendrocytes. So to summarize at this point, we think that our monoclonal antibody recognizes what we call DSD1 chondroitin sulfate domain, a chondroitin sulfate domain based on sulfation and chondroitin sulfate D. This domain is certainly expressed on phospho-CaN and also on RPTP beta zeta 1 as carrier proteins and can be viewed as a new marker of Rayleigh glial stem and also of oligodendrocyte precursor cells. And we think that these glycosaminoglycans are involved in neural stem and glial progenitor cell proliferation and also in differentiation processes. Now, to go on with the questions we have studied with regard to chondroitin sulfates, I would like to show you a result we had obtained when looking at more adult tissues. We found that this DSD1 epitope is sort of strongly enriched on a subclass of neurons. And this was very reminiscent to us in the beginnings of the concept of tripartite synapses. This concept posits that in addition to a presynaptic terminal and a postsynaptic receptor, also astrocytes form membranes that closely oppose to both of these compartments. And in fact, Helmut Kettenmann's lab has shown in a systematic reconstruction that in the cerebellum, these processes form a very complex ramified network surrounding synapses. And there, the glial compartment could contribute, amongst others, extracellular matrix components to this setting. And this is an idea we wanted to follow in light of these results. And in fact, subclasses of neurons that carry extracellular matrix structures are the so-called perineuronal nets that have originally been described by Camillo Golgi. But meanwhile, it's quite clear that these nets are very rich in extracellular matrix superstructures. So they also carry, if you wish, this complex interactome. And also here, there is evidence from James Fawcett's lab, for example, that there is some heterogeneity in the composition of these nets. So there is also some variability. And we have studied these nets in the context of the hippocampus, because we found that we have a strong enrichment of these perineuronal net-like structures in the CA3 region of the hippocampus, here shown in a magnification. And this was a sort of repetition of an observation that had been published in The Human by Brückner's lab in Leipzig already in 2003. So there is a very rich perineuronal net environment in hippocampal neurons. And therefore, we thought that it might be of interest to study the formation of nets and the function of extracellular matrix in the context of hippocampal neuron cell biology. And in order to do so, we have developed a culture system that allows for the long-term culture of neurons under completely defined conditions using a co-culture system where the neurons are in one compartment of the culture system and the astrocytes are sitting on a permeable membrane. Both share the medium, but they do not have direct intercellular contacts. And we could show that the neurons can live and differentiate for more than 21 days, that is more than 3 weeks under these conditions. And we choose these two time points for further analysis. Now, it's possible to monitor in this system the formation of synapses using specific markers for the presynapse and also for the post-synapse. And a very good marker for the presynapse is Bassoon, a protein originally characterized by Eckhard Gundelfinger's lab. And for the post-synapse, you can, of course, use PSD95. And using confocal microscopy, one can see both pre- and post-synaptic puncta appearing in such a culture system. And we have defined the overlap of pre- and post-synaptic puncta as structural synapse, and this can be monitored by the color shift in double exposure. So we can distinguish presynaptic, postsynaptic, and overlapping puncta. And as you can see here, after 10 days, we see the first evidence for structural synapses in rat hippocampal neurons. And this corresponds nicely to what has been published in the literature with regard to this point. And we see, of course, a nice set of overlapping puncta here after about 2 weeks. This system can be used for pharmacological treatment, and we can count the number of overlapping puncta using a semi-quantitative computerized program and the confocal images. And here you see that we have a very nice increase of presynaptic puncta using lysophosphatidic acid, so we can stimulate distinct pathways and change the number of synapses in this model. And based on this, we have decided to test the influence of chondroitinase ABC in these co-cultures. And in fact, we see that upon treatment with chondroitinase ABC, we have an increase in both colocalizing and also synapse-forming puncta. And we think that this effect on synapse formation in our model, that increase on synapse formation, could be interpreted either as removal of an inhibitory effect or as liberation of an attractive factor that would then reach the sprouting axon. And we have tested the different cellular compartments in our model because we can separate astrocytes and neurons in that model and found a variety of genes that are known to affect synapse formation, in particular the semaphorin 3A as originating in the astrocyte compartment in this model, and we will hear more about that in Joost Verhagen's talk later. Another point we have been interested in was the question whether the synapses are electrophysiologically active, and we clearly see miniatures, both inhibitory and excitatory postsynaptic currents in this system using whole cell patch clamping. And we have tested a variety of parameters, and we found that in fact the one which was affected was the amplitude of excitatory postsynaptic currents upon chondroitinase ABC treatment, and this could also be shown in a dose response curve to glutamate exposure in that model. And at the time we thought that this fits nicely with reports by Schocke and Frischknecht and Gundelfinger, who studied the influence of matrix on the circulation of receptors and the recycling of receptors on the postsynapse. And there the removal of matrix would sort of lead to a shift of numbers of activatable receptors in this system. And our results of chondroitinase ABC treatment that also disrupts hyaluronic acid and reduces EPSC responses is consistent with that result. Recently, we have started to use this co-culture model of neurons and astrocytes to test the effect of psychopharmacological agents in our model. And we have compared second and first generation antipsychotics, because these drugs, as a matter of fact, are taken over many years by affected patients and concern a large number of people. And we find that we have an increase of synapse numbers within 3 weeks in our model using the second generation antipsychotic olanzapine. So we can also use this model here to study on a cell biological level the influence of psychopharmacological agents. And I have not time to go into that, but we have also looked at network activity under these conditions using multi-electrode arrays that can also be carried out using our co-culture model. And also there we have seen an increased activity. Now, you could argue that chondroitinase ABC treatment is a rather general and broad treatment, and maybe it would be interesting to have a more specific approach to the matrix and synapse formation. And in order to find an alternative, we decided to study the quadruple knockout mouse model that has originally been generated by Uwe Rauch. And in this model, two glycoproteins of the extracellular matrix, namely tenascin C and tenascin R, have been eliminated, as well as the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan Neurocan and Brevicarn, both of the lecticarn family. The tenascins have emerged with the invention of chordates during evolution. There, the first tenascin can be monitored, and in mammals, we have four tenascins, namely C, R, X, and W. And for us in the nervous system, tenascin C and tenascin R are the most interesting because they are differentially expressed during development. I've already mentioned that this here is a strong component of the neural stem cell compartment and radial glia. I will not go further into that, while this one here comes up later in development, and as it turns out, it is one of the most prominent components of many perineuronal net structures. So we analyzed a system where both of these are missing, and we explored our co-culture system in order to try rescue experiments. How did we do that? Well, we used the co-culture system in order to cultivate separately neurons and astrocytes in separation, combining wild-type-wild-type, knockout-wild-type, wild-type-knockout, and knockout-knockout cells. So we could test whether using, for example, wild-type astrocytes, it would be possible to rescue knockout neurons. And looking at immunocytology, or as expected, we didn't find any of the proteoglycans and glycoproteins of this setting here in the quadruple knockout, because they had been removed. And we saw here under our conditions that the astrocytes contribute tenascin C and Brevicarn. This was to be expected. And we have looked at different parameters in this model, and one we have considered was the activity of the neurons, again determined by whole cell patch clamp, and we see that the frequency of miniature inhibitory but also excitatory postsynaptic currents is reduced in the situation where we have knockout neurons. This is particularly telling here in this case. You see that in the cases where knockout neurons are present, the frequency is reduced, and this is more true even after 21 days. So there is a neuronal phenotype here that cannot be rescued by wild-type astrocytes under these conditions. In addition, we found a tendency of increase of GABAergic markers such as GAD65 or 67, which could reflect an enhanced presence of the GABAergic system in the quadruple knockout. Now, what about the perineuronal nets in this system? The perineuronal nets contain, as I said, many different components of the matrisome, form a complex interactome, including neurokinin and also tenascin R. And we have looked whether perineuronal nets can be visualized in our co-culture model. And indeed, it's possible to see the emergence of perineuronal nets in the culture system. About 10 to 15% of the neurons under wild-type conditions start to form these very nice PNN-like structures that can be visualized using lectins or also, for example, aggrecan antibodies. So you see that PNNs are present, and it's possible to analyze synapse formation on these perineuronal nets by using the pre- and post-synaptic markers I was mentioning. So this here is an example of a neuron that has a very nice matrix code and has both pre- and post-synaptic puncta and overlapping puncta. And when we analyze those, we find that actually where we have here in blue the matrix code, the puncta are absent, and where we have the puncta, pre- and post-synaptic co-localized in forming bona fide synapses, we have no code, as if the PNN would sort of exclude the formation of synapse and vice versa. In vivo, these PNNs are also present, and we see that in the quadruple knockout mouse, there is a reduction in the formation of PNNs, which can also be visualized in the cortex. So in the quadruple knockout mouse, there is a reduced formation of perineuronal nets. And we have thought that maybe this could affect the formation of synapses and started a collaboration with Michael Frotscher's lab to look at this region. But so far, we could not see fundamental differences with regard to synapse formation between the wild type and the knockout on the structural level. When we go into our culture system, we see that in the wild type the wild type combination, we have a nice formation of nets, but the nets are strongly reduced in the knockout-knockout combination. Also, this has been quantified. And again, you see that when neurons of the knockout animal are present, we have a clear reduction of perineuronal nets, both after 14 and also after 21 days. And again, we cannot rescue the matrix by wild-type astrocytes. And to me, this was a deception, because originally I thought that astrocytes contribute extracellular matrix to the nervous system and hence should be able to rescue neurons in this setting. But this is not the case. And finally, we also looked at synapse formation on these neurons, comparing pre- and post-synaptic markers and looking exclusively with focus on the PNN-carrying neurons this time. So not on any neuron, but on the PNN-bearing neurons. And even after 14 days already, we see a very strong reduction of synapse formation in the knockout neurons. So it seems that the reduction of perineuronal nets in the knockout neurons translate as well into a reduced synapse formation, and this could also be seen after 21 days, suggesting that in fact the extracellular matrix on that level may be necessary to stabilize synapses in that context. Because we had seen an influence on the frequency of release of iPSCs and EPSCs in the knockout as compared to the wild-type neurons, we finally decided to collaborate with a physiology group in Bochum. And their first results are now coming up. I will show one experiment, which I find quite interesting, where actually Dennis Manahemans' lab analyzed the emergence of LTPs in freely moving mice that had implanted electrodes comparing the wild type and the quadruple knockout animals. And although the synapse structure seemed to be normal according to the electron microscopy we had done, we see an interesting shift of responses in the quadruple knockout, in that upon high frequency stimulation, we obtain a long-term depression rather than a long-term potentiation. So we obtain an inverse image of LTP in the quadruple knockout, again emphasizing and underlining that we have a neuronal phenotype in our quadruple knockout mouse. So this is there the state of our investigations, and I would like to summarize what we have learned about the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans and innervation. So we think that we have a transient regulation of the density of innervation, and that we can increase synapse formation by chondroitinase ABC treatment. On the other hand, this reduces the EPSCs. The development of synapses on PNN-bearing neurons suggests that we may need extracellular matrix and this interactome to stabilize synapses, and we have clear evidence of a neuronal phenotype in the quadruple knockout mutant, and this is the point where we are now going and trying to find genes that are dysregulated to understand this phenotype in more detail. And this phenotype seems to translate in altered synaptic plasticity, which cannot be rescued by wild-type astrocytes as far as we think. And finally, we have also this aspect of a shift towards inhibitory synapses. So finally, I come to the acknowledgments, and I would like to acknowledge Martin Picker and Marin Geisler for the work on the synapses. This is now continued by Joe Benko and Christine Gottschling. Svetlana Zirko, Alexander von Holst started the work and did the work on the chondroitin sulfates in the stem cell compartment, and there Kazuyuki Sugahara was also very important, as well as Charles French Constant and Magdalena Götz. Tim Chopka started the work on oligodendrocyte precursors that's now being continued by Annika Ulz, and there we collaborate with Oliver Bristol, and here are several colleagues from the campus who contributed to the physiology studies, and Georg Juckel is the head of psychiatry department with whom we are working on psychiatric drugs and their influence on synapse formation. And finally, I would like to acknowledge my granting institutions as well as my current team and you for your attention. Thank you very much.